Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How close did the United States come to joining its European allies and enemies as imperial powers? When President William McKinley was pushed reluctantly into the Spanish-American War with the sinking of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor in 1898, the American appetite was whetted for conflict with Spanish troops far beyond Cuba. That included the Philippines, where U.S. forces, at first welcomed as liberators, were soon seen as unjust and abusive occupiers with no interest in helping Filipinos achieve self-rule. My guest today tells the story of the bitter struggles that followed and of their repercussions on U.S. ambitions and the very image America had of itself in his new book. Greg Jones is an investigative journalist and foreign correspondent who has been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His book is called Honor in the Dust, Theodore Roosevelt, War in the Philippines, and the Rise and Fall of America's Imperial Dream. Greg, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure, Chris. Thanks.
We've thought of ourselves for so long in this country as a superpower that it bears reminding people the state this country was in at the very end of the 19th century, when it was just starting to occur to us that we might wield the sort of influence in the world that, European countries did.
Absolutely. In fact, the United States in 1876 had undergone this reassessment, this somewhat angst-filled analysis of where we were as a power. We were a rising economic power, but we were still a second-rate power. And so this had turned into an expansionist movement. Theodore Roosevelt and others who believed that the United States needed to plant the flag of empire beyond our shores, that not only was that something that was part of our development as a nation, but actually we needed to do that to ensure our economic prosperity in the decades ahead.
So what was the USS Maine, which was the first, essentially the first major modern warship that the United States had built, what was it doing in Havana Harbor in 1898?
In 1896, the long simmering Cuban revolutionary movement had flared back into life, and anti-Spanish guerrillas had reignited their guerrilla war, seeking independence from Spain. The United States obviously was watching these events very closely, 90 miles from our southern shores. A lot of expansionists like Theodore Roosevelt and others wanted the United States to intervene there. And so the Maine was in Havana Harbor in early 1898, ostensibly as a friendly visit. There were members of the crew were going ashore for bullfights. There were luncheons and banquets and other sorts of things like that. But the European powers were sniffing around in Cuba as well. And so it was really a focal point of the United States and European powers that the endgame was being played out in Cuba.
And so when the Maine was sunk, President McKinley, some would say overly, in a way that was overly cautious, and other would say in a way that was entirely prudent, did not instantly want to go to war with Spain. He wanted to know what exactly had happened first.
Absolutely. That President McKinley had fought in the Civil War. He had very, very striking and painful memories of his experience in the war. And he didn't wish to go to war. Theodore Roosevelt had spent the better part of a year as Assistant Secretary of the Navy under McKinley, preparing the Navy for war, preparing America for war, and trying to convince President McKinley that we needed to go to war. Only after incessant hounding by Theodore Roosevelt and also the incessant pounding of drums by newspapers owned by William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer was President McKinley finally convinced that he had to go to war with Spain, or the party was in real jeopardy and his political future was in real jeopardy.
Did Hearst and Pulitzer just want to sell papers, or did they have a great passionate belief that we ought to go to war?
I think it was a combination of both, that the sensationalist press was at its peak in those days, the so-called yellow journalism. Hearst very much wanted a war with Spain. I think because he shared the expansionist point of view to some extent, but also I think that he thought it was a great story and he was poised to cover that story. He had even financed trips into Cuba by adventurers and others seeking coverage of the struggle of the guerrillas against the Spaniards. So Hearst very much was invested in the war. And in fact, once it happened then, he sent his yacht down to Cuba with a number of correspondents on it and brought back some of the first newsreel footage.
And he was one of the few wealthy people who had his own yacht left. You alluded to this earlier, but as Roosevelt is building up the Navy, I mean, they're buying up yachts and fishing boats and retrofitting them and sending them off to war.
Absolutely. That in those first weeks as the United States was about to go to war, our first overseas war since the war with Mexico in 1846 to 48, Roosevelt was furiously trying to prepare the United States, and he was buying up yachts. They were trying to create what was known as a mosquito fleet to protect harbors, to protect the coastal areas of the United States. And so there was this frantic buildup culminated with one of the many fascinating and somewhat humorous things that I found. The development of a fleet of homing pigeons that would be released when the Spanish fleet was sighted out at sea, and the pigeons would come back to the roosts and carry the warning of the approach of the Spaniards. So there was a great fear that Spain was going to sail into U.S. harbors and wreak havoc.
What were their military assets like compared with ours at that point?
Spain at that point was really on its last legs as a major power. Its economy was in shambles. Its navy was pathetic compared to the United States. And the United States didn't have the world's greatest navy at the time, but there had been a modest buildup that had grown throughout the decade. And so the United States was far better prepared for war, certainly, than Spain was. Spain had very antiquated ships, and that very quickly proved to be its undoing in the war with the United States.
Is it fair to say that for Theodore Roosevelt, the war, particularly in Cuba, was as much a personal conquest as a political passion?
Very much so, that Roosevelt had been haunted by his father's failure to serve in the Civil War. His father was a very wealthy man. Theodore Roosevelt had grown up in a very well-moneyed family in New York. And Theodore's father had made the decision not to serve. And Theodore always felt that that was a stain on the family name, that he loved his father very much, was very proud of him. But this was something that really gnawed at him as he became a young man. And so he was eager to have the opportunity to prove himself, which he thought would not only in his own right prove his courage, but also erase this stain from the family name that his father's lack of service in the Civil War had left.
And it would not have seemed when he was a boy that he would be the type who would go off to war and have this desire, this bloodthirst.
Absolutely not. He was a frail, asthmatic, really struggling for life as a young man, very bookish, was not inclined to outdoor or physical activities, but his father continued to encourage him and finally took him aside as a young man and said, "Theodore, you must build your body." And young Theodore replied, I will, Father, I will." And so after that, he embarked on this very rigorous campaign to build his body and to become an outdoorsman, to become a hunter, even though he had terrible eyesight. Was a terrible shot. He, over time, built himself into quite a hunter and quite an outdoorsman.
It is to his credit, whether you agree with his push for war with Spain or not, that he decided to accompany troops there, because it was not something even then that would have been expected of the Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Absolutely. That, in fact, many people thought that Roosevelt was mentally unstable. The fact that he was willing to give up his soaring political career, his position as the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, to set all this aside, to leave his family and to go to war was something that most people of his standing, they could not comprehend. And so Roosevelt certainly deserves full credit as being somebody who believed that if I advocate a war, then I'm obligated to serve in that war. And he did.
Clearly, he enjoyed being this media darling as he was training up his Rough Riders in San Antonio. Can you talk about why they loved him so much and found his story so compelling?
Roosevelt was this in many ways, this Eastern dude, this dandy. And in fact, when he went to war in Cuba, he had Brooks Brothers tailor a canary yellow suit for him, a uniform for him. I use the word suit because that's really what it looked like. And when the men that he had recruited for the Rough Riders first met him, they didn't quite know what to think. Now, some of these men knew him from his time in the Dakota Badlands, from hunting trips. It was a mix, really, of Harvard chums and society chums, and then this rough and tumble cast of characters that he had met during his excursions to the West. But still, he shows up. He's got this Brooks Brothers uniform. He has glasses, which at the time were not a manly thing. And so Roosevelt had to persuade the men that he was really the guy to lead them into war, or at least at that point to be the deputy commander, that Roosevelt recognized his own shortcomings in military areas. And so his friend Leonard Wood was actually appointed regimental commander, and Roosevelt, at least on paper, was the deputy commander of the Rough Riders.
How did they get the name Rough Riders?
The media immediately was taken by this story of this Eastern politician leading this band of men that was, again, this very odd, unusual collection. And so there was almost a contest to come up with the most outlandish name for them. There were Teddies, Riotous Rounders, and all manner of contortions by the press. And finally, the Rough Riders stuck. That was the name that really seemed to fit.
And, of course, people, if they remember nothing else about all of this, they remember San Juan Hill. And it really is an amazing story. They began on – they were mounted, and then they got to a barbed wire fence.
Absolutely. And Roosevelt dismounted from his horse, jumped over the fence, continued to lead his men. He was leading from the front all the way and just roared up San Juan Hill. Actually, Kettle Hill was part of the San Juan Heights that Roosevelt was storming. There were foreign military observers watching from a distance through their field glasses, and they saw Roosevelt and his men when they started up the hill. The foreign military observers were clucking among themselves that along the lines of so brave but foolhardy.
And yet it's the sort of image we can't get out of our heads.
Absolutely, that it made Roosevelt's legend.
My guest is Greg Jones. He's an investigative journalist and foreign correspondent and author of the new book Honor in the Dust, Theodore Roosevelt, War in the Philippines, and the Rise and Fall of America's Imperial Dream. Greg will be addressing the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening. You can find information about that at dfwworld.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, we now have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Greg Jones. His new book is called Honor in the Dust, Theodore Roosevelt, War in the Philippines, and the Rise and Fall of America's Imperial Dream. He's speaking tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Find out more at dfwworld.org. We have an email here, Greg, from Hank in Dallas, who wants to know, wasn't there some controversy as to who or what actually sunk the Maine?
Absolutely. That there was this rush to judgment that was encouraged by Roosevelt and others who wanted the war, but there was question at the time, in fact, scant evidence at the time as to what sunk the Maine. Immediately, those who wanted war were suggesting that it was a Spanish mine that had sunk the ship. But in the 1970s, I believe it was, possibly a little later, Admiral Rickover conducted an inquiry, and the conclusion was that coal dust had probably ignited in the coal bin of the Maine, thus triggering the explosion. That was irrelevant to Roosevelt and those that wanted the war. They really weren't interested in getting to the bottom of what happened.
They seized on an excuse to get it done.
Absolutely.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the Philippines. We've talked a lot about Cuba. So at the same time this is all happening, Spain is also maintaining a tenuous grasp on this Asian colony that it has. And people in the Philippines had been disappointed. Activists have been very disappointed that they were not granted the full rights of Spanish citizenship, which actually had been extended in Cuba, but not in the Philippines.
Correct. The Philippines had been something of a Spanish backwater for more than 300 years. The Philippines was actually Spain's largest colony, but Spain had kept a very tight hold on it. They had not spread education. They had not promoted the learning of Spanish. The church ruled with a very tight hand there. And so the Philippines in some ways had mirrored the unrest in Cuba, that a Philippine independence movement had grown up in the 1870s, 1880s, and then exploded into open revolution in 1896. So right around the same time that Spain was dealing with a renewal of the guerrilla war in Cuba, that Filipino revolutionaries were also trying to throw off the yoke of Spanish rule.
What made, other than the fact that we were already at war with Spain, what made the Philippines such an appealing target for potential colonization or imperialism by the United States?
Then, as now, that China was seen as a great prize. China was seen as this place of countless millions of people at the time, obviously now more than a billion people, but this great market that all the European powers and the United States wished to tap into. And so the Philippines was at China's doorstep. It's in Southeast Asia off the coast of China. And so for the United States, which was late to the colonial game, had not left its imprint in China the way the European powers had, the Philippines was a perfect solution to our being shut out of that great game that was unfolding in terms of trying to see who could gain control and influence in China.
Who was Albert Jeremiah Beveridge, and why was he so influential in this hunger for the United States to occupy the Philippines?
Beveridge was one of many wonderful characters that I enjoyed writing about in Honor in the Dust. Beveridge had grown up on a farm in Illinois. He had taught himself to be a marvelous speaker, walking behind the horse-drawn plow, barefoot through the furrows. And by the time he was in his 20s, he had become a lawyer, had moved to Indiana. And as all of these events broke in 1898 in the United States, then Beveridge started giving speeches promoting the idea that the United States was going to get wonderful, wonderful material benefits from the war with Spain, and that we had to be prepared to seize these opportunities and to plant the flag abroad. In the fall of 1898, as the United States entered this debate over what became known as the Philippine Question, what should we do with the Philippines now that we had defeated Spain there, Beveridge was a key person in this debate, and in fact, in September of 1898, delivered this rousing call to arms that essentially called for the United States to step up, to take on its imperial duties, take the Philippines, and become an imperial power.
And there was very little confidence from within the United States that the Filipino people were capable, and I'm using air quotes there, of ruling themselves.
That's correct, that all of the so-called experts at the time, British and American and other, really dismissed the idea that the Filipinos were capable of self-rule. The Philippine independence leader, Emilio Aguinaldo, the United States had brought him back to the Philippines to fight the Spaniards in the summer of 1898. Aguinaldo had declared a Philippine Republic in June of 1898. It was not recognized by any major powers. The United States certainly didn't recognize, in fact, tried to act as though it hadn't happened. And so there was this conviction that the Filipinos were incapable of self-rule. From the United States perspective, the Europeans were very interested in filling the void of that Spain's defeat had created. And so we really were concerned, and President McKinley, who was not an expansionist, but was worried about, should I leave the Philippines to the Europeans? And so as a result, the idea of Philippine self-rule was quickly dismissed, and it became a question of, should we take all or part of the Philippines?
How long did it take for Aguinaldo and his compatriots to realize they had essentially been double-crossed by the United States?
It happened fairly quickly, actually. The United States Admiral George Dewey, who had sailed into Manila Bay on May 1st, 1898, and destroyed an antiquated Spanish fleet there, had fairly quickly brought Emilio Aguinaldo and his commanders back from exile in Hong Kong. And he had brought Aguinaldo aboard his flagship, the Olympia, sat him down. Aguinaldo would say for the remainder of his days that Dewey and other American emissaries had promised to support Philippine independence if the Filipinos would fight the Spaniards. Dewey would later deny this. But in any event, what we do know is that Dewey sent Aguinaldo ashore with arms, told him to fight the Spaniards, which they did with great success. And by the time a U.S. expeditionary force arrived in the Philippines in July of 1898, Aguinaldo had pushed the Spaniards all the way back to the walls of Manila and had the city besieged. Shortly after the U.S. troops arrived, it became clear that the U.S. had other intentions than what the Filipinos had hoped, which was a grant of independence. And so the U.S., Admiral Dewey and the U.S. ground commander secretly negotiated with the Spanish commander in Manila that the city would be handed over to the Americans. And on August 13th, in what was the final act of the Spanish-American War, a sham battle was staged. U.S. troops were allowed to march into Manila, and the U.S. troops kept Aguinaldo and his army outside the city at gunpoint. And at that point, the U.S. and the Filipinos were on a collision course.
And then we are in it's an interesting reminder to Americans that our history with guerrilla warfare and even with jungle combat far predates either the Vietnam War or the Second World War. It really was the Philippines.
Absolutely. The Philippines, the first phase of the war, which finally broke out in February of 1898, the combat between U.S. and Filipino forces, was a conventional war that the Filipinos were ill-equipped to fight. They were poorly trained. Their weaponry didn't match that of the United States. They didn't have artillery. They were quickly overrun and pushed back, and it was one bloody rout after another as the Philippine army was split in half and the bulk of Aguinaldo's army was pushed northward into central Luzon and gradually pushed further north. And so finally, the only thing that saved Aguinaldo initially was the onset of the monsoon season in June of 1898, June of 1899. And that fall, when the U.S. resumed its offensive, the conventional war was ended rather quickly. Aguinaldo's army was overcome. But Aguinaldo, before making his escape into the mountains of northern Luzon, had gathered his commanders. They had all agreed that a conventional war was no longer practical. And at that point, they decided to disperse and carry on the struggle against the United States as a guerrilla war.
Meanwhile, in Manila, the United States had assigned this commander, Otis, Elwell Stephen Otis, and he was, I guess, a decent administrator, but had tin ears is far too kind a phrase. He had no sense whatsoever for communicating with the people in this country.
Absolutely. General Otis was he's another one of these great characters that's been lost to history, that he was Harvard-educated, had a law degree, was a brilliant man, but he had suffered a head wound in the Civil War, and it had made him an insomniac. And so he sat in his headquarters in Manila and would shuffle paper, essentially, until late in the evening. He rarely left the palace. He had taken over Malacañang Palace, the old seat of power of the Spaniards. And so Otis had no communication with the Filipinos. He wouldn't even deign to meet Emilio Aguinaldo before the United States and the Philippines actually came to blows. He had very little contact with Filipinos. He didn't partake of the social scene at the time, that it was very common for American officers to drive along the seafront in the late afternoons, and it was a great social setting. Otis had none of this, and instead he remained cut off, stayed in his palace, and was really quite clueless, other than the reports that he was reading coming across his desk, as to what was going on in the country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Just an interesting sort of side note here via email from Larry in North Dallas. Larry says, one interesting thing about the war is that it drew a very large group of Jewish volunteers to fight Spain as a sort of revenge for the Inquisition and expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492. When I was a boy in New York in the 1930s, I met a couple of Jewish veterans of the war. Is that anything that you came across in your research?
I wasn't aware of that. That's a fascinating little side angle on it, but I was not aware of that.
Perhaps a book in itself at some point.
Absolutely, yeah.
So talk about this. The Filipinos are – there's this group of rebels. What about the general population? What was the sentiment there about the United States and about the rebels and who might win out and how they were supposed to get by while all this conflict is taking place?
Spain had shrewdly allowed a Filipino elite to prosper during the final decades of rule there. And so the church – held the bulk of power there, but at the same time, there was a Filipino aristocracy that owned a lot of land, that had very much a vested interest in social stability, and so they had been allowed to flourish. The United States, when they came in, recognized that and co-opted this elite rather early on, and so Aguinaldo lacked the support of this elite that had money that could have financed the revolution. And so in addition to being up against a better armed enemy opponent, Aguinaldo didn't have the full support of his own moneyed class, and that support very quickly was peeled away by the United States in what was a very calculated effort.
I want to talk about this. Tony Waller is this U.S. Marine at the center, ultimately, of a torture scandal that is shockingly familiar to us in the 21st century. Tell us first about his background and how, at the age of 41, he ended up fighting in the Philippines.
Waller was a very interesting character. He had grown up in Virginia, the child of a very deeply rooted aristocratic family. His full name was Littleton Waller Tazewell Waller. And it's a very pretentious-sounding name, but it
sounds like cousins got married somewhere in there, too.
That's exactly the case. And Waller was very much a child of Virginia and this landed gentry there. His grandfather had been a U.S. senator, had been an advisor to Thomas Jefferson during Jefferson's final years. Was a very prominent figure, had been governor of Virginia as well. So Waller grew up in this very heady environment. But the Civil War, Waller was born in 1856, and so the Civil War obviously left a very large imprint on his life. It had stripped the Virginia aristocracy of its land, of its power. And so Waller had also experienced that loss. But he had grown up at a time when military service with the war, with the pageantry that went on in his hometown of Norfolk, which was at the onset of the war, was on the front lines of the war, then was later occupied by the Union Army. But Waller had seen, had heard stories of Jeb Stuart and all these Confederate heroes. In fact, one of his brothers later married Jeb Stuart's daughter. So this pageantry of the Civil War, of military heroics and things, were very deeply ingrained in Waller. And so he had joined the Marine Corps in 1880, had seen the world, had risen up through the ranks. He had been an officer. He was commissioned as an officer. And so by the 1890s was really one of the most famous Marine field officers, had distinguished himself in the Cuba fighting as a shipboard Marine. In those days, the Marines were actual gunners. They manned the smaller guns on U.S. Navy ships. And then in 1900, Waller had just been sent to the Philippines, and then anti-foreigner violence had erupted in China, what became known as the Boxer Rebellion. And so this became this large multinational force was sent to China to save the foreign communities and also to increase foreign influence in China. Waller led the first contingent of U.S. troops to China, was distinguished himself, he and his men, with heroics there. Waller became a household name and an American hero. Then he returned to the Philippines and wound up involved in really the climactic campaign of the war.
We will talk more about that in a moment with my guest, Greg Jones. He's an investigative journalist and author of the new book, Honor in the Dust, Theodore Roosevelt, War in the Philippines, and the Rise and Fall of America's Imperial Dream. Greg is addressing the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening. You can learn more about that appearance at dfwworld.org. After the break, we will take your calls. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Greg Jones, whose new book is called Honor in the Dust, Theodore Roosevelt, War in the Philippines, and the Rise and Fall of America's Imperial Dream. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Greg, would that Tony Waller's story ended where you just left it, as a hero right. In the Boxer Rebellion and a distinguished U.S. Marine. But in fact, it took a darker turn when he was in the Philippines.
That's correct. He was sent to the island of Samar, which was one of two hotspots that continued to hold out against American rule in 1901. And in September of 1901, a U.S. outpost on Samar had been overrun by citizens of the town and guerrillas. And it had been a shocking, shocking event. I believe 47 American soldiers out of 74 were killed and 28 wounded. So it was this great event, this embarrassment. U.S. newspapers described it as the worst debacle the U.S. Army had suffered since Custer's loss at the Little Bighorn 25 years earlier. So you get a sense of the shock and outrage that this caused. And so this was significant also because 14 days earlier, Theodore Roosevelt had become president. He had been vice president under McKinley, and then McKinley had been shot in early September 1901 and had died 14 days after this 14 days before this attack had occurred on U.S. troops. So suddenly this war in the Philippines became Roosevelt's responsibility. And he directed his very capable Secretary of War, Elihu Root, a former Wall Street lawyer, end resistance. And so the wheels were turning at that point, and massive U.S. forces were sent to Samar, and Tony Waller and his Marines were given the task of taming, if you will, the southern reaches of Samar Island. When Waller arrived on the island, the commander of U.S. forces in this campaign to pacify Samar was this wonderfully colorful rogue by the name of Jacob Hurd Smith. And I don't use the word rogue lightly, that Smith's disciplinary file is really something to behold. For me, as I was doing research on it, it was a bit like eating candy, going through these fabulous depositions and courts martial and things. It really was sort of watching a soap opera play out. When you review Jacob Hurd Smith's career in the Army and how he found himself a general in command of the U.S., this climactic campaign is an amazing story. But Smith had taken Tony Waller when he arrived off Samar and had told him, "I want you to kill everyone over the age of 10. I want you to leave the area a howling wilderness." And Waller had not executed those orders to the T, but he and his Marines had waged a very, very severe campaign in southern Samar. They ended resistance in a couple of months, and Waller at that point decided to embark on a cross-island march, really in the tradition of history's great soldier explorers. Mm-hmm. Waller did suffer somewhat from delusions of grandeur. He was a very ambitious man. He was already being mentioned as possibly a future commandant of the Marine Corps. And so he embarked on this cross-island march at a very rainy time of the year on a very rainy island in one of the rainiest parts of the world. And so it was not one of Tony Waller's smarter decisions, but he led his Marines into the jungle on Samar. The Marines became lost. They ran out of rations. They fell ill, and 10 Marines were left behind in the jungle. One man died shortly after the survivors got out. And in retaliation, Waller ordered the execution of 11 Filipino porters and scouts who had served his expedition, and he blamed them for the debacle and had these 11 Filipinos summarily executed, which then set in motion a chain of events that caused enormous heartache for President Theodore Roosevelt.
And by all accounts, these local Filipino porters were not responsible for any of the problems they had. They were essentially doing what they were told to do.
That's correct. At worst, from the available record, at worst they had squirreled away some wild sweet potatoes or things like that they had found in the jungle. They had hidden those in their packs and were trying to save themselves, essentially. But they certainly weren't responsible for the Marines being in the jungle on this ill-advised march. They certainly weren't responsible for what happened once they got in the jungle and the heavy rains came and progress became torturous. So the Filipinos indeed stayed with the Marines and even returned with them to the base that they had departed from. So they certainly didn't behave as though they were traitors, as Waller and his men depicted them.
They essentially accused them of being insurgents, and they were not.
Correct.
So Waller returned stateside, still expecting somehow to receive nothing less than a hero's welcome.
Let's back up. First, Waller had actually been put on trial. He had faced a court-martial in Manila on charges of murdering 11 Filipinos. So his life literally was on trial. Waller, during the course of this trial, it was a very dramatic event that was very closely followed by newspapers, the English-language American-owned Manila Times in Manila, and then U.S. papers were following it closely as well. They all had correspondents in Manila, or the major newspapers did. And so this was an event that riveted the nation. It shocked the nation that this Marine hero could be accused of doing something so sordid as murdering 11 Filipinos. Waller, during the course of his defense, revealed General Smith's unlawful orders to him to kill and burn, to kill everyone over the age of 10. And Waller wound up being acquitted. And after his acquittal, he was allowed to leave the Philippines. He went back to the United States in May of 1902. And even then, he arrived back perhaps thinking that he would be greeted as a hero, but he had become to those that had opposed the war in the Philippines, really the face of a war that had gone terribly wrong, that had dishonored America. And so Waller really came in for some very, very extreme criticism, and some of it over the top. There were stories that were completely inaccurate of how he had tortured and had his men fire bullets into various body parts over a number of days to torture the Filipinos, none of which was true. But still, Waller became this lightning rod for a war that had gone badly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Lewis in Dallas. Hello, Lewis.
Hello. My question is, could the author tell about the Black American soldier in the Spanish-American War and Mr. Roosevelt's relationship with him, please?
Thanks
and
for
I
a call.
My answer offline.
Sure.
On Roosevelt's wonderful day, as he referred to it, his crowded hour, that there were African American troops that were in the charge going up San Juan Hill, that they were not under Roosevelt's command, but they certainly distinguished themselves. And once Roosevelt and his Rough Riders and then other units made their way up the San Juan Heights, up Kettle Hill and San Juan Hill, that you really did have this melting pot up there of you know, everything from the Tiffany heirs and Roosevelt's very, very moneyed Eastern friends and all these other rough-hewn characters, and then African-American troops as well, who incidentally were commanded by Captain John J. Pershing, who later became Black Jack Pershing, which is how he got his nickname. It was not a complimentary term that his brother white officers gave him, but it was because General at the time Captain Pershing was commanding Black troops, and so those troops and the Rough Riders were all victorious atop the San Juan Heights, but certainly. The Black soldiers distinguished themselves in the Spanish-American War in Cuba, and later fought in the Philippines as well with distinction.
Were they given their due at the time?
Not really. Obviously, at the time that keep in mind that the South, this was when the Jim Crow South was starting to really unfold, and so Roosevelt, who was always a very strong advocate for what were described at the time Negro rights, African American rights, particularly in the South, that he was a strong advocate and took steps to try to acknowledge the service. And in fact, very early in his presidency, within days of taking office, Roosevelt had gotten himself in hot water with Southerners by inviting the Black educator Booker T. Washington to dinner at the White House. And so Roosevelt, I think, made attempts to certainly acknowledge the service, but as far as getting their due, that was something that really wouldn't come for many, many, many decades.
So, Greg, to what extent did the scandal with Waller and this war having sort of gone in a direction that nobody, from the beginning at least, wanted to take it, how much of that stuck to Roosevelt and his political career?
Not a lot of it, and a lot of that reason is because what came afterward. This was not certainly Roosevelt's finest hour, but Roosevelt was an extraordinary human being, an extraordinary politician, an extraordinary American. And given all that he did afterward in terms of attacking business trusts, of breaking the unbridled power of big business at the time, establishing national parks, of making sure that Americans had safe food and drugs and things like that. That Roosevelt did so much that obviously has been the focus of the many biographers who have come after and have chronicled his record. And so this happened very early in his presidency, in fact, predated his presidency and then the first year of his presidency. It certainly affected American attitudes, and Roosevelt was convinced that the price of expansion and imperial reach and military conquest was perhaps too high, was certainly higher than he was willing to pay in his political career. But Americans, after a steady drumbeat of news, of bad news from the Philippines, of these trials and investigations involving atrocities, torture, and other things, U.S. Senate hearings that stretched from January of 1902 into the summer of 1902, Americans quickly wearied of that, and I think were really discomfited by these revelations and turned away rather quickly. And so even in the midterm elections of 1902, the Republicans under Roosevelt fared quite well, even after all of these revelations. And in 1904, the Democrats tried one last time, the anti-imperialists and the Democrats. The anti-imperialists, it should be noted, really spanned party lines. It included a lot of Republican anti-slavery activists and others who simply believed that expansion betrayed our founding commitment to liberty. But in 1904, the Democrats tried one final time to make the Philippines, our actions in the Philippines, a central issue in the campaign, and they failed miserably.
What do you think is the legacy of all this today?
I think that I certainly was struck in 2003, more so in 2004, 2005, and 2006, of when in this country we debated the invasion in Iraq, the use of American military force, and then some of the extreme tactics that were unveiled in Iraq, waterboarding and other things, and the antecedents were certainly in the Philippines. It was known as the water cure in the Philippines. That I was really struck by the fact that so few Americans recalled that we had gone through a very similar episode, a very similar debate, a very divisive period in our history, and it had almost disappeared from our national memory. So I'm not sure that that it has had a lasting effect.
Greg Jones is author of the new book, Honor in the Dust, Theodore Roosevelt, War in the Philippines, and the Rise and Fall of America's Imperial Dream. He'll speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Chris. Thanks.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.